Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's Friday, the 22nd of May, a Friday before a holiday weekend. You decide if that's room for reason for celebration. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and wonderful to have you all with us and to have our panelists with us and ready to go for a good, solid conversation before we head off to celebrate the weekend. Let me introduce our panelists to you. A reminder, you can always join us, panel at WAMC.org. Write to us. Keep your notes short, to the point, on topic, and proofread them so we know what you're actually trying to say. The use of verbs is always helpful. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Well, good morning to you, Big Joe. We've already talked a couple of times this morning, but we'll keep on talking today.
Well, you know, we have a lot to talk about.
Indeed. We do.
But everything going all right? You got your walk in today?
Yeah, I did my walk. It was a little slow, but I did my walk.
It's a beautiful morning, great weather.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people out now.
Good.
People are finally joining me in an exercise program.
At 4 in the morning, so that's good.
Actually, no. It really is. It makes basically 5:45. Quarter to 6, and then you get home or a little after 7.
Yeah, that's still early, but that's good. Early bird gets the worm and all that.
Right, as long as I'm not the worm.
That's right. You don't want to be the early bird. Senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, Judith Enck is here. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I don't know if you can convince a jury, but you sound all right. Aaron Vicini joins us as well. He is a Siena College economics professor. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everyone. I'm doing adequate.
All right. Everyone's just sort
I don't
of
know if that's a sentence, but that's how I'm feeling.
Yeah,
adequate.
Everyone's just sort of adequate. Yeah, I think that sums up the mood of the room. That's okay. Well, good to have you here. I don't know if you've heard us, but we've been saying over the last few days that we really need an economist. We really need Aaron, and so we'll rely on you heavily this morning, I'm sure. Thank you for being here. Also, the man that we always rely on, corporate attorney Rich Honan, in the house. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? I'm a little worried about the sound quality, though. Can you hear me?
You sound fine. No, you sound fine. Oh. Yeah, no, you sound good.
I'm great. I'm rocking. Hi, Judith. Hey, Aaron. Good to meet everybody.
It's really good to it's good to have you here, Rich. Thanks for being here. Always nice to have Rich on the program and all of our panelists coming together. We appreciate it, and we appreciate you joining us this morning. Let's go to what is happening in the world, and as far as I can tell, it's it's kind of a lot. So here we go. Now, as I say that, then I realize that I don't. Okay, there we go. Now I found the stories. We have a lot to talk about, and I want to, just because Aaron hasn't been with us for a while, and this is a huge issue, so let's maybe start with the economy and layoffs. Article in the New York Times that many jobs may vanish forever as layoffs mount. 38 million U.S. unemployment claims in 9 weeks. One economist says the situation is grimmer than we thought. Even as states begin to reopen for business, a further 2.4 million workers joined the nation's unemployment rolls last week. And there was growing concern among economists that many of the lost jobs are gone for good. Aaron, that is scary, isn't it?
It is scary, but it's also pretty accurate. Yeah, we've seen a 30% decrease in economy-wide employment since mid-March. And again, the scale and speed of that is unprecedented. So, unemployment numbers are going to continue to rise, even with reopenings. I think that's important to point out because a lot of people think that, the shutdown and the quarantine, from mid-March to, the end of April, beginning of May, that was obviously a major factor in driving the spike in unemployment. But it's important to note that even with a lot of these restrictions being eased, just because of people's fear of, going into retail establishments and bars and restaurants, that there's going to be a persistent decrease, and it's going to be very long lasting in terms of, purchasing power. So I think the worst in terms of the spike of unemployment is over, but I think what we're going to see now is far more insidious and far more damaging to the economy, and that's kind of the slow grind of just an economy that's operating below capacity with double-digit unemployment lasting, even with conservative estimates, to the beginning of 2022. So these temporary layoffs that were the only bright spot in last month's unemployment report are likely to become permanent as the payroll protection program ends, as a lot of establishments who have managed to stay in business are probably going to be forced out of business just because of decreased consumption and people's health fears about going into public. So perhaps the worst is over. There might be a second bigger wave coming where we might see a resurgence in unemployment claims and infections. But again, I think the biggest threat, and I was happy to see Jerome Powell and Steve Mnuchin talk about this earlier this week when they testified before Congress, mm-hmm. is this very slow, very persistent grind of an economy that's operating at 60 or 70% for years. And that can do long-lasting damage to people's, pocketbooks, the likelihood of them getting a job, their investment portfolios, you name it.
But the other side of that was that in Mnuchin, especially Mnuchin, but certainly also Powell, saying that the economy risked permanent damage from long lockdowns. That blame on long lockdowns, I think, is a little concerning, right? Because it seems as an excuse to open everything up, whether we're ready for it or not.
That's true. And, if you notice, Jerome Powell, who was appointed by President Trump, but whose term he does not serve at the pleasure of the president, as Steve Mnuchin does. If you notice in all of his speeches, he does not blame the lockdown. He's very cautious in terms of blaming the health crisis. So blaming the lockdown, that explains a large percentage of the massive increase in unemployment in March and April. But even if there was no lockdown and there were no restrictions in place, consumers and businesses would act the same way. They wouldn't be going out in public. Businesses would have a very different model about how they engage with the public. And all roads lead to Rome. You're going to end up at the same place. It's just a matter of how fast and with how much collateral health damage. So I don't think blaming the lockdowns is useful or accurate. Blaming the coronavirus is the accurate statement.
Rich Honan, what do you make of this?
excuse me. I never disagree with Aaron usually, and I certainly don't disagree with him on matters of the economy. I guess my question, Aaron, would be, how much of this comes back in a year? Would you say a year from now?
Well, the answer is some. I'm going to rephrase your question, if you don't mind, and I don't like putting words in people's mouths. It's not so much a matter of how much of it comes back. I think the question is, and the question that's on a lot of people's minds, is how long does it take until we get to where we were in terms of the number of jobs before all of this started? So how much of this bounces back once restrictions are lifted? Probably a relatively small percent. I think unemployment's going to continue to climb at, through 2020 at minimum. And then it might start coming down in 2021. But it's going to, it might take, a year or two to get a measurable bounce back. It's going to take, 5, 6, 7, 8 years to even come close to getting back to where we were from an economic standpoint from when this started. And there's a lot of assumptions there that, you know, there's a vaccine, that there are, you know, that people are following basic health protocols and so on. And all of those are big ifs at this point.
Alan?
Well, you know, part of this, of course, is you guys are exactly right, is the quality of the vaccine. We don't know. If it comes back, the economic implications are going to be severe. For those of us who will not be going into a movie theater for a while, and I would love to poll the group on that, or going to a densely populated restaurant, I think, you know, Aaron is exactly on target. I mean, it isn't only whether things are open, but whether people will go to the open thing. Now, Trump, of course, is playing it so that, you know, this is all pre-electoral fodder, in that the bad Democrats are the ones who want to keep things closed, while I want to open things up. And for all of you who are being frustrated by all of this, whose jobs are at stake, I count on the fact that you'll come around and vote for me as a result of all of this. But I think the main question is, do we get a resurgence in this? Is it going to come back again? Do we have a vaccine? All of those are going to be playing a huge part.
Judith.
Well, I think, you know, the fact remains, this is a tragic mass casualty event. This morning, they're reporting over 95,000 Americans have died. Worldwide, it's 330,000. And I'm sure you saw yesterday the Columbia study that if the government had acted just 1 week quicker on shutting things down and social distancing, 36,000 needless deaths would have been prevented. And also the economic damage would not be as severe. I think the Trump administration clearly is not focused on keeping Americans alive and does not understand the connection between the health protections and economic recovery. And I fear that if we get the second wave, you know, the response will be similar because it'll be closer to the election. And I know there's criticism of de Blasio and Cuomo not shutting down earlier, but imagine if we had a president who, rather than denying the facts that were presented to him every day in his briefings, imagine if we had a president who supported a nationwide lockdown. The deaths would have been dramatically less, and the economic damage would have been dramatically less. I read yesterday, in terms of the economy, one in five mothers report that their children at some point are hungry. I don't know why they're only polling mothers and not fathers, but one in five mothers reporting that their kids are hungry at some point during the day. And yet the federal response is to reduce food stamps, not increase it. So this is a death spiral in every sense of the word. It's an actual death spiral for so many people, but also it's an economic death spiral. And I don't see the Trump administration having the capacity to get us out of this.
I'm just going to take one part of what you said, Judith, and not to get away from the meat of what you were just talking about. But one of the things that struck me, too, in just the few minutes that we have, is that yesterday we had the highest number of cases reported worldwide and in the United States.
Right.
And that story basically goes unnoticed and not talked about because we are focused instead on the recovery, on coming back and reopening. And I'm just wondering why that's the case, and B, it seems as that is inevitably going to bite us at some point, of this ignoring of these numbers steadily going higher and higher.
Well, Joe, absolutely. Ignoring...
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rich.
Go ahead, Judith. No, the question is
Judith. I'll go and then you can go, Rich. You can wipe it all up. I think I'll give you more fodder. The numbers are also going up in Texas, and they reopened quite early. I think I'm now going to criticize American media. So buckle up, Joe and Alan. From the beginning, American media covered the coronavirus more as a political story than a medical story. And just a huge amount of time on what the president said. I know you have to cover the president. I know you've got to cover those dreadful White House briefings, which thankfully have gone away on a daily basis. But the medical issues need to be front and center. And the situation you just described, Joe, that should be the headline in every newspaper today, and it's not.
I would only half argue with you. I don't really disagree with anything you said. I would only half argue that I do think on those briefings, when you had the medical professionals out front and center, that we were getting more information than we're getting now.
Mm-hmm. Fair point.
Yeah. Rich, we have about a minute, but then I can come back to you right after the break, too.
Yeah. Well, no, just the isn't the increase in cases directly proportional to the increase in testing? I mean, is somebody out there saying more people are actually getting sick? Or is somebody out there saying we're all doing more testing, which everybody had clamored for, and as a result of the more testing, we are getting more positives? Now, what I haven't seen, and maybe it exists, Judith, I haven't seen it, but I haven't gone looking for it, is if you're telling me the hospitalization rate is increasing as precipitously, you know, I understand that. But I think even CNN has pointed out that, or has acknowledged that the increased case rate that it keeps publishing is a function of the increased testing.
That is not correct. There are parts of the country where rates are going up, particularly in the heartland and certainly where those meatpacking facilities are. It is incorrect to say that you have more cases because you have more testing. It's like saying you have more breast cancer because you have more mammograms. We have an infectious virus that is still out in our environment.
Judith, I have to pause you here.
Yes,
and then
please.
When we come back, we'll continue with that, because I do want to talk about hospitalizations, which are, and the reports are down. So I want to talk about that as well. We'll be right back.
Looking for redemption in his Jameson all night. Well, I wipe down the bar and I can't wipe away his past. Well, I just pour another shot of whiskey in his glass.
Hearing from the Steel Drivers this morning from their new album Bad For You. You can see the playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. Judith, go ahead.
So I my major point is, as a country, we've already tried don't test enough, and it hasn't worked. Remember, early on, very hard to get a test. We now have close to 100,000 Americans dead. I know the president has said that testing is overrated, his word, not mine. It's kind of like ignore the problem and it will go away. It's not. And so we've tried it Trump's way. Maybe it was not a planned strategy of not having testing and not having contact tracing, but let's consider that experiment done, and let's consider it a failure at high cost, and make sure that we ramp up testing and contact tracing so you know where the virus is. Epidemiologists say that even when there's a small outbreak in a small community, you need to find it. You need to contact trace so you have a fighting chance of containing it. So no, testing is not open, and we need much more of it, not less.
Rich?
Well, that's a response to some point, but not the point that I made, which was simply that the increase in reported cases is probably a direct function of the increase in additional testing. I'm not arguing against testing. I think it's fine, but that's obviously where the increase is coming. I actually just have one question
and not to, I know that we always kind of get into politics, but just so I could kind of, just so I can kind of get my bearings on this, Judith, so who do you blame more? Do you blame President Trump more, or do you blame the government of China, or is it equal to you?
I think the blame is on the virus, which, you know, is affecting the whole world. I blame both China for not being much more transparent and warning people and taking corrective action sooner. It was horrible that they silenced the first doctor who spoke out. Not having a functioning democracy hurts in a global pandemic. And I definitely blame Trump for wasting valuable time. All you had to do, if you didn't want to listen to his briefers or read his daily briefing, all you had to do was read the newspaper. It was on the front page of every paper, what was going on in Wuhan, China. And yet Trump was talking about, you know, keeping people on a cruise ship offshore because he didn't want more than 15 cases in the United States. I cannot hold the government of China accountable. I can hold President Trump accountable for literally killing people.
Alan.
Well, I've been thinking about this a great deal, and it's beginning to happen already. I mean, I saw it in the paper. I've been saying it for days. I would take, Judith, I couldn't agree with you more. I would take Trump saying, we only have 5 cases. We're only going to have 15 cases. It's a Democratic plot. Each of those should be a campaign ad. It seems to me, for the Democrats, if they knew what they were doing. If they don't do that, there's got to be a reason, and it would be very disturbing to me, but I see at least one congressional candidate is already doing it. Each of those utterances, which proved your case, Judith, so well. I mean, how can you say there are only going to be 5 cases or there are going to be 15 cases? It's crazy.
And Rich, I understand your point. I really do. But it still means you have that many cases in the country, which is an alarming number, right?
Sure.
Okay. That's all.
But you know, you say read the papers. Go back and read the New York Times, January 31st. Read the New York Times. This is your paper, not mine. Read the New York Times. January 31st.
You have ownership, Joe?
Yeah, we didn't.
I didn't know you were that wealthy.
I didn't.
When I became Sulzberger.
Joe Sulzberger, right. Go ahead.
I'm going to jump aside to give props where it's due. Today's puzzle in the New York Times was one of the best weekday crossword puzzles they've ever had. And I'm not going to say anything about it because I don't want to spoil
anybody.
Don't
ruin it.
It was terrific.
All right.
So the New York Times, as late as January 31st, that's when they're reporting the response to Trump closing down the travel. And it wasn't just out of China. It was closing down travel of people who had passed through China. Okay. And read that story. Read Anthony Fauci saying, you know, we don't know anything about anything. Read the few amounts of cases that were around then. Read how much the New York Times is basically taking shots at Trump for roiling world markets and rattling the economy by doing this. You know, I think you guys are looking at things now and weren't, you know, not the way things were at the time.
But he was the president at the time. He was the president. His job, he's the one who closed down the pandemic action group that Obama had set up. What are you talking about, Rich? The answer is this is a presidential function. He wants to be the top dog. He is behaving miserably, and he didn't do his job.
Alan, I'm not going to deny that this was – I'm not going to deny this was an intelligence failure of, and I'm talking, you know, from the intel community, and I'll put that on the president as well because he's in charge of them. I'm not going to deny it was an intelligence failure of high order, not understanding earlier that China was going to do this and the extent to which they were willing to go, which frankly I think surprised all of us. I'm not going to defend that. But for, you know, for Judith to say, and I'll defer to Aaron on this, but Judith, for you to say that had we done a nationwide lockdown right away, somehow the economic effects would not have been as bad. That's remarkably counterintuitive to me. Aaron,
I'm saying it 1 week earlier, not in January. Look at the Columbia University study of 2 days ago. If the lockdown and the social distancing happened 1 week earlier, we would have prevented 36,000 deaths. And the economic connection, what you and the Trump administration, and I am lumping you together this morning, and I apologize, but you are sounding like a Trump defender. What you fail to understand is that if you don't contain the virus, the economy doesn't recover.
All right.
Go ahead, Aaron. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, not me. I'm out.
Now, Aaron, did you want to answer Rich's
question?
Can I jump
in real quick?
Yes.
The speed, forget about politics. The speed with which this virus appeared caught everybody off guard. And you can see that with, what happened in Wuhan in, January. It caught people off guard. I can't believe I'm saying this. I don't think democracy is the best form of governance to deal with controlling the spread of a pandemic. You need authoritarian responses. You need mandatory lockdowns. You need severe penalties for people who aren't wearing masks, for people who go outside, who venture outside or into businesses. You need severe penalties for businesses that stay open or are operating on a black market. In order for that to happen, you also need social cohesion, where people are willing to follow the dictates of a government for the greater good. And China had that. So in the short term, the economic damage of a immediate lockdown, extreme fines or imprisonment for people leaving their houses, for businesses staying open, that's the best solution to dealing with the initial outbreak. Yeah, that causes absolutely catastrophic economic damage for maybe a couple months. And then once you can test people, you can isolate people who have tested positive. You do the contact tracing. That rebuilds confidence for the majority of the population who is not infected. So that's kind of, you rip the Band-Aid off. You rip the Band-Aid off very rapidly. What's been happening in the U.S. is this wishy-washy, there's some national policies, and then, there's the Federalist policies where states can take their own approach. That's pulling the Band-Aid off extremely slowly. So you might not get that initial economic abyss, but what's going to happen, and I referred to this earlier, is you get something much worse, is that you get a less damaging abyss in the short term, but you have years worth of limping along, both in terms of testing, isolation, and tracing. And you get those long lingering effects of double digit unemployment that's going to be with us for another 2 years.
I Aaron, you're my guy, but I got to disagree with you on that, because effect of a national lockdown, of a federally mandated everyone in America basically stay at home. And I understand I'm overstating this. I understand it's not necessarily stay at home, but the effect of that, first, forget the enforceability, just in our kind of society and our kind of culture, I think that would have been far more devastating in both the short and long term. Then the other thing that argument avoids is the idea that there's still a regional locus to this as well.
Yeah.
We're just outside of New York. My whole family lives in New York City. It's devastating. The only thing you think about. But there's lots of areas, even of New York State, let alone the country, where that would be a massive overreaction. And to lock down an entire, region of a country in our system, I don't think it would be doable. And I actually think the effects would be worse, both economically and socially.
Rich, you and I know. Can I just go for a second? You and I know that so much of this is now political. We know that this president thinks he can't be reelected unless he gets the economy open, and if he kills people doing it, so what? I mean, he's been for opening this economy helter-skelter, recklessly from day one. So, you know, I gotta say, you know, your argumentation is good, and I think that every political person, including Andrew Cuomo, has to be extremely careful about how he plays this. I don't think this is a guy. I think Cuomo is not a guy who wanted to, you know, reopen things, but he knows the economic pressures are so great. But I'll tell you, the president is the guy who, from the very beginning, has been irresponsible about this.
Alan, I will say to you, and here's another thing you and I know, and I think Judith probably knows this better than most just because of her background. We are always balancing basically economics against safety. We've been doing it forever, and we're doing it now. No one likes to talk about it. But, you know, Judith will tell you when you're balancing the environmental law, you know, Trump's deregulation of the environmental laws, Judith can testify way better than me, has had effects. It's had good economic effects. You're going to argue it had bad health effects. We're always balancing that. No one wants to come out and say that, but that's what we're talking about. How many lives are worth it? To be able to get the economy back on track. That's the calculus. It's grim, but that's the question.
I'd like to jump in here. I 100% agree with Rich. We as a society place a value on human life anytime people buy insurance. Insurance rates are calculated on the probability of dying and the expected costs. That happens with life insurance, auto insurance, health insurance. This is something that is embedded into the U.S. economy. So that is a permanent calculus, and it should be no different here. You're weighing cost against benefits. And when you have a pandemic that has no known vaccine, people are going to die. And the question is, how do you weigh the well-being of people who live in Nebraska with a very sparsely populated, very different economy than New York City? It's not a one-size-fits-all approach, but getting back to the initial response, a 1 month national shutdown where the Defense Production Act is invoked and you produce, you know, hundreds of millions of testing kits, personal protective equipment, and so on, and distribute that. All of this boils down to the economy is not going to recover whether lockdowns are lifted, whether restrictions are eased, until you can rebuild the confidence of consumers and businesses to get back to normal. And whether that happens because of the vaccine, whether that happens because of quarantining, infecting individuals and doing contact tracing, whatever the method is, you need to rebuild confidence. And it appears that the U.S. has failed on that front dramatically.
All right. We are wait for a break. So I'm going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a ton of letters. I know I was shocked too. We'll go to those and keep going on this conversation when we come back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. 50 minutes past 9 o'clock, 10 minutes before 10, and we welcome you to our conversation. Alan Chartok, Judith Henk, Aaron Pasitti, and Rich Honan making up the panel this morning. A lot of letters, so I'm going to read these. If you hear your name, feel free to respond. Rich, that's you. Will.
I hope somebody's going to call him on the insurance analogy, and the insurance company's making all that money. Not exactly kosher.
Christine writes, I'm very upset that Rich is defending the president and his minions over the handling of the coronavirus. Thousands of more people will die by the end of the summer in the United States alone. These are the people who are dying for the Dow in the words of Paul Krugman. And don't think you can't get COVID. I did, even with taking precautions everywhere I went and maintaining social distancing. I was one of the lucky ones. David writes, Judith is right. I live in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, different part of the world. With many poultry packing plants, the numbers are rising. Harrisonburg is a hot spot, yet our community acts as if the problem is over. We need testing at the poultry plants, yet the governor is not responding. The public needs to know the danger. Judy writes and says, it was not an intelligence failure. Trump dismantled the health surveillance apparatus and ignored all national preparations for health crises.
I said so.
He also obstructed provision of PPEs. He sidelined well-informed, capable medical advisors for some fantasy world he chose to favor. There is much more to say, but it's all repetition at this point. I wish Rich would stop seeing everything in dollar signs. He doesn't seem to accept the magnitude of the health threat. Would you like to answer that charge, Mr. Honan?
No, I'm good.
Can I answer that?
Okay, that you can. Smart. You can. Sure.
The health threat and the economic damages are.
Aaron, 1 second. Rich, we are trying to make good radio. Just remember that. Go ahead, Aaron.
I understand.
All right, I'll make good radio. I'll say something that's probably a little out of character and probably something where I agree with Rich more is that the economic damages and the health risks are inextricably linked. The lockdown, again, whether there was a lockdown or not, the economic damage was going to be catastrophic. And whether we have 30% unemployment or 20% unemployment, you're talking about depression levels. So to say that there's a trade-off is exactly right. Other countries like China, who haven't experienced negative growth rates to the extent you believe their statistics for 20 plus years, have now reported that, yeah, our lockdown caused a 7% contraction in economic activity. We're not going to know whether that was a successful policy, the very draconian measures China took, probably for years. So a lot of this is trial and error, and I think people need to accept that policy is going to be trial and error. And yes, there are some best practices, testing, isolation, and contact tracing. And the whole goal of this is to rebuild confidence amongst consumers, to venture out in public, knowing they're not going to be mingling with people who haven't been tested and might be carrying the virus. Until you do that, until you build confidence back up, there's not going to be an economic recovery to speak of.
And I want to add one other thing. Rich is correct. Every federal environmental statute, for instance, requires a cost-benefit analysis. But this was not President Trump and his very ineffective appointees sitting down and saying, okay, these many people are going to die, but this is the economic benefit or input of that. What really drove this is Trump's desire to get reelected. And he did not want anyone at the CDC or anywhere else talking about the coming storm. He silenced medical experts. And I think for maybe the first time in his life, Trump is encountering something that he can't talk his way out of. He can't tweet his way out of. The virus doesn't care about his tweets. And so you'll notice the complete lack of empathy from the president. You'd rarely hear him talking about the thousands who have died, expressing remorse, expressing respect. I mean, I'm so struck by, after the 9/11 tragedy, there was national mourning for those who have died. And today, there's rarely a mention of the people, the stories behind the people who have perished. And I think Trump's lack of empathy and Trump's only priority as president is to make sure he gets reelected. And that's what drove this entire federal failure.
That's right.
Anything you want to add, Alan?
No, I said that's right.
That's right. Okay. Let's go to another letter who we have, as I said, lots of letters, so I'll try to get, we got about 3 minutes before we go to a break. Lars says, good morning, all. The response would have been much faster had Trump not cut the pandemic research department that had scientists in Wuhan. We would have known about the seriousness in November or December had this cut not been made. Dan says, working at home doesn't require as many highways, cars, airlines, restaurants, real estate, corporate buildings, cleaners, plumbing, and heating, and so on. There will be no... I think what they want to say is there will be new service industries to replace them, but the cost savings will not go unnoticed by CEOs. Mike says, panel, Rich's questions. Who do you blame more is very revealing of his politics and right-wing talking points. What does that question prove and why is it relevant? We are the nation in the world with the worst death rate, and that is due to President Trump and his administration's response. His politics are now deadly serious. Rich?
I think that question to me frames, you know, where you're coming from, how you can blame anyone above, how you could put more blame on any entity above the Chinese government. It shows to me a degree of disengagement from reality that I can't really respond to.
Well, the reason why the point is a very valid one and why we keep relitigating these issues is because it's apparent that Trump has not learned from his mistakes. Remember, he was telling everyone to go to church on Easter Sunday, and then he walked it back. If people had done that, many, many more people would have died from simply practicing their faith. Yesterday, he was saying that he's directing the CDC to tell people it's okay to go to church. In many parts of the country, that is not safe. And so he keeps repeating the same mistakes, which is why the death rate keeps marching up.
I think there's zero data on that. And I think that if you remember, it was the federal government that, you know, started the policy of social distancing and reducing people getting together in groups. I'm not convinced that if social distancing is practiced properly and people wear masks and do all the things that the government, including the federal government, have told to do, that there aren't certain things that could be done safely, including going to church or temple or wherever you want to go.
Well, Trump only mentioned church. He didn't mention temple or mosques. And he is overruling his CDC today. The CDC does not want people congregating in faith settings and other settings. And yesterday, Trump said he's telling the CDC that people should go to church. So my only point here, it's not about religious liberty, is that Trump keeps repeating the same mistakes. And there are implications to that, both from a health perspective and certainly from an economic perspective. And for the sake of the country, Trump also should be wearing a mask, which he didn't yesterday. Apparently he did when he was behind the scenes and said he didn't want the public to see him wearing a mask. So he took it off when he was in front of the cameras. The total opposite. He should be modeling the recommendations of the CDC. Everyone has to wear a mask except him.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll continue with this fun. We love your letters. We have lots going on, and we'll continue after news with Ray Graff.
She ain't sad, and that's two of us, glad I'm gone.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Judith Ink, Aaron Presidi, and Rich Honan on this morning. We just got word that Governor Cuomo will be speaking at 11 o'clock this morning, a little earlier than normal. So 11 o'clock this morning, and we'll be going to that live as soon as it becomes available. We have a lot of letters, so let's get to as many as we possibly can. Sean writes to us and says, I think people need to rethink our economic outlook on this pandemic. We will not ever get back to the way we were. We're always moving forward, economically speaking, based upon the motives of the market and corporate interests. As always, the middle class and small business will suffer the most, and the top 1% will maneuver a way to be okay, and many will actually come out ahead. The question is, can Joe Biden harness this enormous calamity and frame the discussion into a meaningful campaign to hopefully win the presidency? Does he even have an economic plan to address this current crisis that he can articulate to the American public? Who would like to take that question?
I'll take a stab at it.
All right. Go ahead, Aaron. Thank you very much.
So lockdown restrictions or not, this was going to be a health crisis and an economic crisis of unimaginable proportions. So forget about, you know, the politics about what caused this. The important question now is, how do we get out of this accomplishing both of those goals with the minimum damage to the economic side and the health side? We missed a major opportunity in terms of the first stimulus bill, which was large, the CARES Act, but also reasonably ineffective. What a lot of other, particularly European countries, did is have a work-sharing program where the federal government would pay businesses directly to keep workers on the payroll at reduced wages. So that prevents that giant spike in unemployment that we got in the U.S. early on. That's part of their social safety net and something that's lacking in the U.S. Now, I know the payroll protection program was supposed to kind of mimic that, but it was too late in coming. So I think what we need now is, given the unemployment crisis that is going to be here for at least 2 years, we need to start thinking about what to do with all of those workers who have lost their jobs. And you're going to see a lot of businesses fail. You're going to see a lot of businesses establish themselves, new businesses that might deal with cleaning and disinfecting or testing or contact tracing or whatever. So I think what Biden should do that he has not yet done is talk about some new deal or a 21st century new deal where you have government guaranteed employment in targeted industries. Perhaps, you know, health services would be an obvious one, or social services, but couple guaranteed employment with job training and job training that's targeted towards not only growth sectors in the short term, but growth sectors in the long term, like, you know, green manufacturing and areas like that. It needs to be bold. These small steps where you kind of nibble around the edges of the problem aren't going to take care of the issue. They might soften the blow. But if, you know, Biden wants to be serious, I think the country is prepared for dramatic and costly intervention. And I think the solution to that is guaranteed employment for workers who have lost their job, coupled with some form of job training that prepares them to re-enter the workforce in the private sector with the skills necessary and the skills that firms are going to be demanding. And he hasn't done that, and he really should.
All right. Good answer to that question. Ed writes to us and says, Trump may very well think that he needs a good economy to get reelected, but does anyone really believe a good economy is necessary for Trump to win in November? Haven't the rules changed a bit here? At this point, won't a struggling economy play directly into an only Trump can bring us back narrative?
Alan? No, I don't think so. I think, in fact, we know a long history in this country of if things go wrong on somebody's watch, they get blamed for it, like it or not. People don't know how to change things, but they do know that they don't like what's going on, and they vote that way. That's what the polls are showing us right now. Now, when you add up why so many people are sticking with Trump, it comes down, and I've said it again and again and again, which it comes down to this sort of racist imperialism, you know, this business about, you know, we want to keep things the way they are. We want to be in charge. We don't want a lot of other people doing this stuff. So from my position, he's in real trouble and he knows it.
Jeffrey writes to us and says, congrats on your successful fund drive. And speaking of which, I just received a request from the Trump campaign. I had to reply, however, that, quote, after 3 years of this needless travesty, Mr. Trump's pathetic response to the pandemic has only managed to make me even more embarrassed and ashamed to admit that I'm a lifelong registered Republican. This demented moron should be removed and jailed for treason, and McConnell should resign for dereliction of duty. I can't believe how Pelosi looks like a hero compared to them. That from Jeff in Rome. We go to Donna, who says, Rich tried to put most of the blame on an intelligence failure, and I'd like him to respond to the fact that Trump was warned about this beginning on January 18th in a combination of presidential daily briefings, Alexander Azar, Peter Navarro, and other officials, which he chose to ignore with claims that it was a Democratic hoax and that it would magically go away. I'm mad at China, too, but let's not act like that absolves Trump on his direct responsibility for the deaths of 30 to 50,000 due to his inaction.
Good letter.
No, I think China clearly has the direct responsibility. I'm not absolving anybody of blame, just to be clear. You know, there's 90,000 people dead and 30 million people out of work. So I don't think anybody at any level of government should be taking it. Whether it's New York, California, or federally, including President Trump. The one thing you have to remember, people say, oh, you know, ignored warnings. You know, anybody who's in any level of management, Joe, you know this, Alan, everybody. Every day you have people coming to you who are very invested in their area of expertise, and they know a lot more about it than you do, and they're trying to get your time and your attention. And they sincerely believe that what they're positing to you is the most important thing facing the company or the country.
Yeah,
and imagine multiplying that for imagine multiplying that, you know, if you're a president or a governor. And, you know, I'm sure every bad thing that's ever happened, there has been somebody at some level of government who foretold it. That's just
Rich, every time every time he gets into trouble, this guy says, I don't know this guy. They fire an inspector general. They do this, that. Hey, when you're the head of an organization, trust me, something goes wrong at WAMC, somebody's going to be coming at me. When you're the head of an organization, you have to take the responsibility of being the head of that organization. And, you know, you just can't absolve him of, you know, not knowing or not being guilty or having been warned too many times. He was warned, and he was warned by some very important people, and he ignored it.
These were red lights and sirens. I mean, when your staff comes to you and say there's an international pandemic and we need to prepare for it, and he prefers to watch TV all day, that rests with him. This is the, you know, history is going to be written. And this, I would argue, is the most significant example of presidential failure and irresponsibility in the history of our nation. I don't see how you can say many people are coming to him on different problems facing the country and he didn't focus on it. Well, he should have been front and center. I mean, this is when leadership really matters. This is an unconscionable failure on his part. And I do remember the head of respiratory disease at CDC speaking publicly and saying that this is serious and schools need to begin to think about teaching remotely. And what did Trump do? He tried to get her fired. And so she's been silenced. I mean, anyone who has raised the alarm here has been faced with being fired or being demoted. I mean, this is not how a functioning democracy works.
Judith, nobody in America, certainly in the age of Trump, has ever been silenced, okay? Between whistleblowers, between leakers, between people who send things direct to the New York Times, no one has been silenced. He may not listen to them. He may disagree with them. But the difference between
lots,
this country
lots
and
of, say,
not, is
you're
that
wrong.
People are not
you're,
silenced.
People at the CDC have been silenced. This is used to be a very respected agency. It was the gold standard. Most of them have sounded the alarm. They've either been silenced or fired. Very few go to the press because they know how risky that is. And when you can have scientists speak, look, there was, Rich, there was just an inspector general report out of EPA yesterday where the inspector general documented that over 300 EPA scientists reported being sidelined or silenced on issues like climate change, drinking water, air pollution. It's a problem in virtually every federal agency. And when you don't listen to scientists, when you're in the middle of an international pandemic, the results are quite negative, to say the least.
Let me go to this letter from... go ahead.
Can I chime in real quick? To Rich's point that, you know, yes, I will agree that people have been silenced. You know, that's just that's the fear approach. But, you know, a lot of people have been not so quietly reassigned, like Rick Bright. Mm-hmm. People who have spoken out, you know, kind of get, you know, pushed down into the basement office without windows. There's a real threat to speaking out and saying what is politically unpopular, but something people need to hear.
Aaron, while you have the spotlight for a moment, Vita says the coronavirus has laid bare many structural weaknesses in our economic system. Aaron, can you take a few minutes, and if you had a free hand to build a better economic system, what are some of the changes you would make? Go, Aaron.
Okay. Wow, that's a... Doing that in a few minutes will be a challenge. I've said this so many times, the biggest long-term threat to the U.S. economy is the rise in income inequality. Rising income inequality sucks purchasing power from the middle and upper middle class, who are more likely to spend money, and, you know, siphons it up to the top, you know, 1% or the top 10%. This has been happening for decades. So you have stagnant incomes for, you know, 90%+ of the population. So dealing with inequality, I think, will fix some of the structural problems. And you can do that with instituting a living wage instead of a minimum wage. You can massively subsidize higher education. You can provide universal health care. But I think the most dramatic strategy to reducing inequality is government guaranteed employment coupled with targeted job retraining that equips people to acquire skills that are necessary for the long-term health of the U.S. economy, while at the same time creating jobs in sectors that can pay living wages, essentially replacing the role of old school, you know, heavily unionized manufacturing in vehicle production and so on, and replacing that with a new 21st century type of manufacturing. And I think the Green New Deal lays out a very coherent, admittedly ambitious and costly platform, but trying to, you know, rectify 40+ years of rising inequality and diminished opportunity for 90% of the population. If you're going to fix that, it needs to be bold.
All right. Anyone on that?
Well, those are the things that Joe Biden should be talking about. I know that there's a school of thought that, you know, Trump is sabotaging his own reelection. So, you know, Biden should just kind of quietly and let the train wreck happen electorally. But many of the issues that Aaron just articulated should be articulated by Democrats running for office all over the country. I mean, we are, you know, the same symbol for crisis as opportunity. And this is an opportunity to have those very deep discussions about what do we want our future to look like. Clearly, the healthcare system did not hold up well during this crisis. Let's start with healthcare and then work through all those issues. You know, I think people are thirsty for leadership.
Alan?
We had a very good letter from our friend Daisy Foote, who writes to us a lot, who said, you know, Joe Biden has been talking a lot about many of these problems. You're not listening. Well, you can't listen if you don't hear it. And I think that Biden and his people have a responsibility for getting that stuff out there. Because if the tree falls in the woods and you don't hear it, it didn't happen. And I have to say that while I happen to believe that Biden is now nationally 11 points ahead, that's huge. 11 points, that's big. And going up. It's going in the right direction as far as I'm concerned. Maybe not rich, but I think so. And I got to tell you, but the Democrats do have a responsibility for making people hear.
We got this from Jen, who says the name of the subject line of the letter is the Judith and Rich debate. Why does every argument between conservatives and liberals need to be black or white? Not everything is that simple. Please remember that the lockdown happened to save hospitals from being overwhelmed. With hospitals overwhelmed, we would have seen more deaths from the nurses and doctors trying to save lives to the public that would become sick and not have a bed to get treatment. There is plenty of blame to go around, Republican and Democratic. But there is no excuse for the Trump administration's lack of taking the virus seriously from the start. If I, as a citizen, with nothing more than news reports at my disposal, could see this virus as a threat, he should have seen it, with all of the governmental resources at his disposal. Trump has blame in this, but you cannot blame China for Trump's lackadaisical attitude.
I think that's a very good point. You know, I do think that Trump made it clear from day one that he didn't believe in this virus. We've had many letters on this who keep pointing out he said there were only going to be a few in this country, that it was make-believe, it was a Democratic plot. He said it again and again. Come on. You know, how can you possibly believe that he doesn't have a great deal of blame that is attached to his name?
Tony,
and the reason why Rich and I are relitigating this, why I am, is because Trump still doesn't get it. He is making the same mistakes.
So what if he does get? Hey, Judith, what if he does get it? That's what's
so. And he doesn't care. Yeah.
Oh, I think he gets it. I think he's a very bright man, and the only thing that matters to him is he's devilishly bright, by the way. And the only thing that matters to him is getting where he wants to go, which is to stay in the White House another 4 years.
I agree. That's all. The only thing he's focused on is his reelection, and he thinks that not talking about 95,000 American deaths helps him get reelected. But just on a day-to-day basis, he is advancing policies that are very dangerous for the economy and for our health. I think he still doesn't get the health economy connection, but you're absolutely right, Alan. This is not a debate between the two. He is just driven by his reelection desire.
Go back to the letters. Tony says, how on earth is it safe to go into a Home Depot or Walmart where it is a mob scene, but not okay to go to church or some other store? Unbelievable. We have truly had weighed social distancing and have picked winners and losers. Surprise, surprise, the winners are big business.
Well, I'd like to comment on that. I think, you know, CDC just put out a report yesterday. They looked at people who attended church services in a rural Arkansas church. 38% of the people who attended tested positive for COVID, and ultimately three people died. That was in early March. And we don't want Home Depots packed with people. I take that point. But church services, you know, by definition, people are sitting next to each other. And as of yesterday, the CDC was not recommending that people congregate again. I'm sure that recommendation is going to change, but it's not based on science.
Linda writes, go ahead.
It's not true that people sit next to each other. People are practicing. The whole idea is always, and first of all, I agree with the writer who said it's not black and white. That's correct. You know, so even those of us like me who are advocating loosening up the restrictions because, yes, we have flattened the curve and all that, we're still advocating social distancing. We're advocating wearing masks. And that's the same thing people would be doing whether they're going to church or Home Depot. I know when I go to the grocery store, everybody does that. We're not saying, you know, run around coughing on people. We're saying do it within the parameters of what's been established.
Anyone? Okay. All right. Back to the letters. It's so funny listening to you all expounding on how things should go in a global pandemic. Are you time travelers who've lived through one somewhere, somehow, once already? You love listening to yourselves talk, says Peter. Thank you.
I like that letter because it points out just who's out there. Have we ever been through one? No. Can we read history? Yes. Can we read about the Spanish flu? Yes. So if you haven't lived through one, then you don't deserve to talk or to hear yourself talk. Sorry, you need to go to the lumpen proletariat.
But we are living through one now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it's in real time.
Go ahead.
And there are countries in Asia who have experienced pandemics, in Africa, and we do have information about, you know, practices that have been more successful, practices that have been less successful. So no, we do not have perfect information about the appropriate response. Like I said earlier, it's going to be a lot of trial and error, but we can kind of cherry pick best practices that have been used in more modern pandemics, not necessarily in the United States, and think about how to adapt those for our social structures.
And by the way, Aaron, you're quite right. If you take a look back at the Great Depression, Roosevelt didn't come in and say, here are the five rules you got to follow. He tried a lot of stuff. Some of it worked, some of it didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Trial and error.
We have just about 2 minutes. I want to get as many letters in before our break. Brandon says, what about all of us that haven't stopped working and we don't get any more money, even though we've had to pay the same bills, buy the same but now higher priced items, have all the kids home, which costs more for food and snacks all day, every day, and don't get any relief? Good point.
And how many people who write that letter or letters like it? I'm sure that, you know, we can't hold this letter writer responsible for it. How many people continue to say Trump is, you know, terrific? And we know the demographics. It is puzzling to me, but there are many people who can't put food on the table who think Trump is a god.
Anyone on that? Judith, were you going to say something?
Mostly, I looked at some polling yesterday. There's a huge gender gap and female voters. And we're not suggesting this letter writer is a Trump supporter. I think the letter writer raises really, really good points. And,
Judith, I saw something that somebody sent me about polls and how many women were for Trump and how many women in each demographic were for Trump. And I said, this letter could have been written by the Russians.
Kat says CDC wasn't cut in China. It was reorganized regionally to be more efficient. Meanwhile, CDC asked to send people to China and China refused. Yeah, the panel agreed with Biden that CDC didn't make an effort. Trump never said that he didn't want the public seeing him wear a mask. He said the reporters. Oh, I have to take a break. I'm sorry. I was just dinged here. We have to go to a break. We're desperately late. When we come back, we'll continue with the letters and we'll have more conversation coming up. Good morning. Welcome back. Ruth writes to us and says, greetings. After hearing Aaron's list of what our economy needs, I say Aaron for president. Then Jerry writes, just listening to Aaron's description of what is needed to bring the economy back, all his points are spot on. May I point out that these were all the points that Bernie has been espousing for years, yet no one paid attention. Biden needs to listen to Bernie and push for some of these reforms.
Well, two things on that. I think to some degree, I think we can all agree that he is listening to Bernie. I mean, he's including a lot of Bernie platform material in his own now. And I think it's very important to think that that is true. And let's all remember that when you say no one was listening, come on, no one. You got a lot of votes.
Aaron, anything you want to add to that?
These structural problems the U.S. economy has been facing, I mean, date back.
No, I mean, are you running for president? No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm not running for president. I will I will delegate my ideas to Bernie, and he has not yet called for any advice. So
I would vote for Aaron over Bernie.
Well, thank you.
We
do
have the same hair. Mine's a little darker, but.
All right. Let's see. Sadie says, it's not just the body proximity when it comes to church. It's the singing, which projects droplets of right. up to 10 feet later, laser measured. Think of the person who had to laser measure church spit. JJ says, hello, panel. I feel Trump is anti-American. He's destroying our democracy, and I don't understand people who are unable to see this. Our country is not only in danger of the coronavirus, but a president who warms up to our enemies, calls the press enemies of the people, dividing our country between red and blue, to state a few. Trump does not unite. He divides. Abraham Lincoln said, a house divided will fall. If we do not join together and fight against this anti-American, our country will fall. We go to Peggy, says, hey, Alan, have you invited Joe Biden to have a WAMC interview?
Well, I don't know that we have. We invited a lot of people, and we certainly will. If your point is, and I think your point is, that you bitch about the message not getting out, and it's your fault, come on. You can do better than that.
Robin says, this is my first time commenting succinctly. Without people, there will be no economy or politics to worry about. The focus should be on preserving life, whether for the better good or not, things will resume. Then Oliver says, true, many staff members come to American presidents with urgent matters. Some presidents prioritize human lives. Some presidents prefer to prioritize money. Let's not even go into prioritizing their own fame and electability. A looming pandemic threat was not urgent enough to rise to Trump's attention. Then Jill says, I haven't watched Governor Cuomo's press conferences lately, but during a conference I watched last week, Cuomo did not wear a mask either. I'm no Trump supporter and I love our governor, but I have to call it as I see it. Governor Cuomo didn't wear one.
He wears masks when he goes out in public and
When his walking captain the other day was wearing a mask, I believe.
When he does the press availabilities, people are spaced out. I don't mean spaced out there.
No, they're six feet apart.
6 feet apart. So that's why he doesn't wear it.
And he wears it usually walking in and takes it off when he's speaking, is what I have noticed. Alan, I'm sorry.
No.
Okay.
No. I'll sit here in the dark.
What?
I'll sit here in the dark.
Oh, I don't know why.
I missed something. Forget it.
I'm sorry. The economy is king. Yes, we all know that. But Rich and Aaron are correct. However, the utter lack of direction, strategic planning, or intelligence. Let me read that again. Let me see if I get it right this time. However, the utter lack of direction, strategic plan, or intelligent thought from Trump has caused the death toll to soar. If we had a nationally dictated plan of action at the outset with definitive objectives and goals, lives would have been saved and the divisive environment that has emerged would not be rearing its ugly head right now. Trump has, once again, further divided the country for his own personal pleasure, not unlike the Roman emperors who filled coliseums and feasted on blood sport.
I think the final sentence was a little too far.
Okay. Yeah.
Just a little hyperbole there.
Okay. Edie says, perhaps with the benefits to the environment as a result of the virus, i.e. cleaner air and less atmospheric heating, we will appreciate the result and lose the driving to the malls and encourage local businesses and walkability. This way, small biz will return and smart growth will prevail. Judith.
Well, carbon emissions are now down 17% since the world's economy was shut down. That's a good thing, but they're going to shoot back up when airplanes and cars and trucks are on the road. And as I've been saying, a global pandemic is not a clean air strategy.
Bruce has a question for Aaron. Doesn't the continuing reduction in aggregate demand drive successive waves of new unemployment?
Yes, that is I was trying not to use technical terms, but the writer nailed it right on the head. Is that
the writer took that at another step. Go ahead.
The lack of the lack of federal leadership created a lot of uncertainty, and with uncertainty comes a lack of confidence, And when consumers and business face a uncertain environment and don't have confidence in a coherent strategy, the immediate survival reaction is do nothing or prepare for the worst. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, to the extent that Trump wants to get reelected, I think he misjudged this, and that the public interest aligned with his self-interest in getting reelected. Provide leadership, get this under control so the economy can reopen and we can have a, you know, reasonably quick recovery. And he's chosen to do the opposite on both counts. So, yeah, that's the slow grind I was talking about. The initial spike in unemployment is alarming and catastrophic. It's really going to be the next 2 or 3 years where we're going to see this just painfully slow growth, painfully high unemployment, earnings losses, hours cut, wages reduced. That's the bigger threat to the economy, not the initial loss of jobs and output from the lockdown.
You know, Joe, something's been sticking in my craw. Perhaps it's inappropriate to raise it, but I think somebody wrote about going to the malls and how few people are going to be going to malls. Well, malls have been having a tough time, at least in Berkshire County they have, and I think in other places also. I think people sort of got, it may be distracting from our central conversation, but I think people have gotten kind of tired of them.
Yeah, and I mean, their point was is that it would be good for the local economy and would be good for, because if we get into the point with so many of those stores going out, that we have an opportunity now to shop in our local communities.
No, I get it, and I got to tell you, I do. I absolutely do believe in shopping locally, and always have. Even if you pay a few cents more, it's just important.
But more people are shopping online, which is, not people should think that you can also support local businesses online. But everyone is going to Amazon, and
everyone,
many people, and it shows. It does. I mean, the Amazon sales are through the roof. I mean, Bezos is
he's going to be the
significantly richer. Yeah. I mean,
where are they getting most of that stuff from, Judy?
All over the world, including China.
That was not the correct answer, yes, Jeff.
Including China and the U.S.
Mainly China.
And my point is that you can shop online with local stores.
That's right.
Peter said, I just had a conversation with my primary care doctor about the impact of COVID-19 on our area, meaning Greater Saratoga County. The day before, he had two patients on suicide watch due to the economic impact of COVID-19. This is a human dimension of the economic question. It is real. Absolutely.
It's a great letter and very important, because an awful lot of people are sitting home with every kind of resource as well as with no resources and feeling depressed.
And it's really hard not knowing what the future holds.
Sure.
That's difficult. Bob writes, good morning. Please speak to the notion that if China is made the scapegoat for the coronavirus, then the Trump administration's delay in responding to the pandemic will be overlooked. People are starting to believe that China unleashed this pandemic on the world deliberately. If that idea takes hold, won't Trump have created a something?
Pompeo said it. He had to take it back.
Trump will have created another great distraction. Rich.
Well, that's been the China talking point since the start of it, right? The China talking point has been, it's not our fault. This is Trump's attempt to cover up his inability to handle, you know, this simple, you know, or this crisis. And that, everybody who repeats that is repeating the China talking point on that. I don't even know. I'll even give you that maybe they didn't deliberately set out to do this, but they clearly deliberately gave misinformation. They clearly withheld information. They clearly have been stepping up operations in the South China Sea. They clearly put the lock on anybody getting PPE out of China, places like 3N. And they clearly allowed travel outside of China, but not internally in China around Wuhan province. So I don't know that the first step, the actual first transmission, was deliberate, but everything after that certainly was.
I'm surprised you didn't mention Hong Kong while you were at it, Rich.
Well, but look what they're doing there, Alan.
I couldn't agree more. It's terrible. It's just awful. I'm no big fan.
And I'm just saying, we're all rational people. We're fairly intelligent. I don't need to think. I'm not saying it's 100% China. It's 0% somebody else. I'm not saying that. But to ignore the fact that we would not be in this position were it not for a series of deliberate acts by China, even taking out the original transmission, it's just unrealistic.
Probably have time for one or two more letters. Teresa writes to us and says, church, synagogue, or mosque is not a building. It is the people, the congregation. I've been attending my church services and council meetings via Zoom since the second week of March. Those services have been meaningful and inclusive of all ages and health status. Gathering in a building is not yet safe because of the time, number of people sitting, standing for an hour, speaking, singing, all prime ways of virus spread inside a building, even with fabric masks and attempted distancing. I'll continue to attend and advocate for virtual services and meetings until it's safe to meet in person. Then Caroline says, I have tried often to buy online locally for pickup, but most times items continue to be out of stock. Just to voice the other side of why people may not be buying locally online. I would say be persistent. Let's see.
I would also say try to buy triple layer toilet paper online. You won't find it there either.
Tim says, amid crisis, there is opportunity. Shouldn't we be discussing and developing new programs with kinds of jobs and new kinds of jobs and businesses? Why isn't there more recognition of the value of the WPA approach and the opportunities of new jobs in infrastructure, farming, green energy, etc.? Aaron, you were talking about that. You were a little bit more on the health front, but yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the possibilities of new jobs that can be created to help kind of rebuild the structure of the U.S. economy is going to be radically different after this period. The question is, do we meet that head on and are prepared in advance to meet those challenges and provide jobs in sectors that are socially and economically important, or do we just sit back and wait and let things play out and then adopt a reactive approach?
And that is particularly true for local agriculture. The food supply is at risk at some points, and I really appreciate Congressmember Antonio Delgado has put support for local agriculture front and center in his congressional work.
We are out of time. I want to thank all of our panelists for being with us this morning. Coming up, we have the Congressional Corner. Alan's going to talk to U.S. Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts, and then we'll have Governor Cuomo at 11 o'clock. Alan, thank you. Have a great weekend. Judith, Aaron, Rich, thank you all. I appreciate it. We'll talk
soon.
See
you on Tuesday.
All right. Thank you. Yes. Thanks. Bye-bye.